This presentation has been previously broadcast.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, I promised the gentleman who called and asked about the passage in Matthew 5 where Jesus says, you know, if you call your brother fool, you will be liable to hellfire. That's in Matthew 5:22. And I did my homework. I did more homework, I should say. And I think I found the answer. This is from St. Augustine. And he talks about this at some length. And there's a variety of things that he says on this topic. But the key is this. He says, in all these three sentences, and so I'll read the passage again. This is Matthew 5:22. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother shall be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother shall be liable to the council. And whoever says you fool shall be liable to the hell of fire. So in the Catena Aria, which is St. Thomas Aquinas' compilation of the noteworthy comments made by the church fathers on each verse of the four Gospels, St. Augustine has a variety of things to say, but he concludes his commentary by saying this. He says, in all these three sentences, there are some words understood. In the first, indeed, as many copies read, without cause. In other words, there some of the manuscripts where it says, but I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother, and some of these manuscripts include the phrase without cause, shall be liable to judgment. So St. Augustine says, in the second, he sees the second, he who says to his brother, Raka, we must supply the words without cause in order to understand it properly. And again, in he who says, you fool, two things are understood, to his brother and without cause. All this forms the defense of the apostle when he calls the Galatians fools, though he considers them his brethren, for he did it not without cause. So that seems to be the pivotal issue here. That it's not, as I was speculating earlier, necessarily a figure of speech or hyperbole, but rather that the context here is saying that if you are angry with somebody without cause, then you're liable to judgment. You're committing a sin because you're holding anger in your heart against a brother or a sister, and you don't have a reason to do so. Therefore, that would be sinful. Second statement, whoever insults his brother without cause shall be liable to the council. So if there's a reason that this has to be brought out in public, then it's not sinful. But if there is no reason or without cause, then it would be. And then lastly, whoever says you fool, and the phrase there, as I did a little bit of searching, it means empty-headed or to be empty. And as St. Augustine points out earlier in his commentary on this passage, he says that if you're talking about your brother, he's not empty because he has the Holy Spirit in him. He's the temple of the Holy Spirit. And so it would also be a lie or a slander to accuse him of being empty when in fact he's actually not empty. And in this case, if you say you fool without cause, then you are liable to the fire of hell. So he explicitly exonerates St. Paul when he calls the Galatians fools because he did it, as St. Augustine says, for cause, with cause. So there you have it. And if you're interested in the Catena Aria, that's a Latin phrase. It means the chain of gold. And it's referring to the statements on the church fathers about scripture. You can get it in book form. You can find it online. I happen to have it, the complete library of it, in an app that I like an awful lot. I have no connection with the app. There's no benefit to me whatsoever. But if you're interested, it's called the IPIETA, P-I-E-T-A, IPIETA. And this app contains an absolute goldmine of documentation, the church fathers. You'd have to look at it to see everything it has, spiritual writings, the Holy Bible, the Summa Theologiae, et cetera, et cetera. So I like having it on my phone because I could be on an airplane or on a street corner or in a coffee shop. And if somebody asks me a question I don't know the answer to, I can see what the church fathers had to say on it or see what St. Thomas had to say on it. And I find that very helpful. So that's the rest of the story. Let's go now to Allison in League City, Texas. Good morning, Allison.
Good morning, Patrick. Last night, we had family staying over for the end of summer break. Mm-hmm. And one of the little ones, we were talking about sacraments. And it got into talking about one of the miracles of the fishes and loaves. Mm-hmm. And then one of the little ones, he's about seven, he was like, well, how did God get all this power to make everything? And I was like, you know what? That's a good question for one of the walking, talking encyclopedias of relevant radio. And my eight-year-old was like, you know what, Mommy? I have the answer to that. And she ran and got her In the Beginning book. So I read the book. But then I was like, that kind of only answered half of his question. And I don't even think that was his question, love bug. But it was a good read before bed. And she reminded me, Mommy, we have to call Patrick. And I said, I'm on it.
Oh, that's sweet.
So
that is sweet.
They're kind of shy about getting on the phone. So they're in the other room listening to the app. So they're all your ears.
Okay, little ones, gather around. And thanks, Mom, for letting the kids listen to this. So how did God get all this power? I think the best way to explain it is that God is, by nature, infinite. And what that means is, and the word infinite may not be readily accessible to the little ones, there's no end to his existence. There's no end to his beauty. There's no end or limit to his power, his love, his glory. So all of those attributes that God is. So we have attributes like your knowledge is an attribute that is an echo, you might say, of God. You have an intellect, you have a will, you have beauty, you have unity, etc. But it's all limited. And it ends at a certain point. In God's case, he is those attributes, and so that extends to his power as well. So anything that can be done that is not contrary to God's nature, he can do it. There's no limit to it. There's nothing he can't do as long as it's not contrary to his nature. So an example of that would be God can't be bad. God can't lie to you. It's not that he's not strong enough to lie. It just means that it would be contrary to his divine nature. So he can't do anything that's contrary to his divine nature, but all those things that are consistent with his divine nature, he can do, which means then that his power is unlimited. So it's not that God got that power somehow. It's not like he figured out how to become powerful or at some point he became more powerful than he was before. No, from all eternity, which is hard for us to imagine, but from all eternity, God has always existed, and as God, he has always had and is all of these perfections, all of these attributes. So that's probably the only way I can really explain it. It's hard to point to something you really can't point to anything in nature and say it's like this, because everything is created and God is uncreated. So from all eternity, kids, think about this, you know, and spend the rest of your lives thinking about this. And then eventually when you see God face to face, you'll see what right now we can only think about in a hazy kind of way. But just ponder the fact that God is all-powerful, all-knowing, all-loving, all-beautiful. Everything you can imagine about God in a good way, he is all those things, and it's unlimited. And he's always that way. He was never not that way. He's always been that way, always will be that way. I think I've exhausted my ability to explain this to 3-year-olds, but hopefully that's helpful.
That was awesome. Thank you so much. My 3-year-old, my 7-year-old, and our 8-year-old will be so thankful. So I want to say their thank you to you, and thank you for me.
You're welcome, Allison. Thank you. God bless you. And so you have those three, and are they regular Patrick Madrid Show listeners, those little guys?
Yes, we are. And I have a 16-year-old and then another family member who's also a 16-year-old that's listening as well. My 16-year-old is at work right now, but she is a regular listener as well. And as soon as she gets in the car, if it's 3:00, we're saying the Divine Mercy. And if we're on our way for our morning shift, we're listening to the Patrick Madrid Show. So it's the family that when I called before that we started for Lent to listen to you. I don't know if you remember, but
I do.
We called. Yes, sir. Here in Lake City.
Well, that makes me super happy, yes. Allison. I'm grateful, and thank you to you and all your whole family for listening to the program. We sure appreciate it.
Yes, sir. Prayers always, and have a blessed day, Patrick.
Thank you. You too. Man, that is so awesome, especially the little kids. It just amazes me, always has, about how even the younger kids, they just find something interesting about the program. You'd think that it would be over their heads most of the time, but yet parent after parent has told me that the kids like listening. So who am I to argue, right? 888-914-9149. Let's go now to Maria in Austin, Texas. Hi, Maria.
Hi. Good morning, Patrick. Good morning. Yes, I actually started listening to Relevant Radio because my mom used to listen to Relevant Radio a while back. So that's the fruit of
that's great. The seed. Thank her for me sometime.
Thank you. And well, I had a question. My firstborn passed 10 years ago, and unbaptized, of course. And just recently, I started offering mass intentions, like for her birthday or for her the day she passed. But my question is, offering a mass or including her in a rosary offer the same purpose for her soul, even though she's unbaptized, than for those that that are baptized in the church?
Can you say that one more time? I want to make sure I understood your question.
Sure. So I'm offering a mass for my unbaptized daughter.
Right. No, I get so that. But you're asking, is the mass more powerful for those who have been baptized versus who have not been baptized?
Yeah. Like, does it same? Does it, you know how we can offer a mass for the soul of those who passed? So does it? Is it the same thing as far as like offering the mass because we're trying to save their soul? Is it the same for those that are not baptized and those that are, I guess?
Okay, so I see what you're saying. So you can offer a mass for an unbaptized person as well as for a baptized person. And the question then is, will it help them or how will it help them? I think it pivots on this issue, Maria, is that if the soul of any person, so we're not talking about your child right now, okay, just for a minute here. We're just going to talk about a person who dies without baptism. If that person is in hell, then the spiritual benefits of the mass will not help that person because they're beyond help. If, on the other hand, that person who has died is in heaven, then the spiritual benefits of the mass that's offered on behalf of that person are unnecessary because that person is already experiencing maximal happiness, seeing God face to face. So in both cases, God would apply the spiritual benefits of the mass to some other person who needs it, and that person would be in purgatory. So that's where the question, I think, is unanswered, in that it would be, in the case of a child who died before baptism, where is that child? If the child is in heaven, then the mass that you're offering for her, it's wonderful that you're doing that, but it would be unnecessary for her, so God would apply those benefits to other people. If she's in purgatory, in other words, waiting to go to heaven, and the only people who are in purgatory are those who are destined to go to heaven. There's nobody in purgatory who's not eventually going to end up in heaven. So if presumably your unborn child were in purgatory, then that would be of spiritual benefit to her. So because we don't know one way or the other, you just simply do the best you can, and you have masses said, and they're said on behalf of your child, and you trust in God so that in his mercy, they will either be applicable to her, or if she's in heaven, then they would be applicable to somebody else. But God will not let those graces go to waste, so to speak. Does that make sense to you?
Wonderful. Yes, that paints a good picture. Well, thank you so much. You have a blessed day, and thank you for everything that you do.
Thank you, Maria. Thank you. Wonderful. We have the best listeners here at Relevant Radio, and I'd like to think we have the best listeners here on the Patrick Madrid Show, but I know you listen to multiple programs, so I can't claim you all for myself. Let's go now to Christopher in Central Ohio. Hi, Christopher.
Hey, Patrick, how are you doing this morning?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Your gentleman called in a little bit ago questioning why the picture of the Last Supper showed people reclining. mm-hmm. at table. And obviously, I'm not a theologian, so I don't know this for a fact or anything, but in reading Pope Emeritus Benedict's Saint Jesus of Nazareth, mm-hmm. he noticed that the Passover may not have been the actual Passover meal. One thing it could have been is the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which mm-hmm. precedes the week of Passover. Mm-hmm. And if you notice where Jesus dies on Good Friday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, mm-hmm. that was the actual time that they would have been preparing the lambs for sacrifice, or been sacrificing the lambs in the temple.
That's
which
true.
Suggests also why they were able to witness the curtain being torn from top to bottom. Obviously, somebody had to see that. Mm-hmm. So I think, and this is Scott Hahn has references too in his Ignatius Study Bible, that this Passover meal was not the actual Passover meal that the Jews would have celebrated, but was Jesus' Passover meal, because he's right. passing over from this life to, you know, the heavenly right. kingdom.
Yeah, I think that's correct. I think that is.
So therefore, there wouldn't be any reason for him to stand, because it wasn't the Jewish Passover meal in the traditional sense, although he certainly used a lot of the elements of that. And some of this is out of the Scott Hahn's fourth mm-hmm. cup.
And I have great respect for Scott Hahn's scholarship. So I remember him saying that, and I remember reading about that in, I think it was the Lamb's Supper. It would make it that much more understandable why we're told that they were reclining at table. So, yeah. I agree. I concur.
So just, yeah, words for thought. And Patrick, I love your program. Absolutely. Just blown away by what you do. And I think the reason children like listening to you, you have such a natural voice. I mean, your radio presence is wonderful. And just listening to you is soothing. So I think you're a true gift to the church.
Well, you're very kind. Thank you. It's nice to know that you're listening in Central Ohio. Are you listening in our Youngstown area? We have stations in Youngstown.
No, I'm listening on the Relevant Radio app. Uh-huh. I'm a member of St. Matthew the Apostle Parish, so I live actually in New Albany, technically. Wow. But right now I'm in Akron for work, and I just was on my driving to Akron. I listen to you whenever I get a chance. If I'm in the car from 9 to 12 Eastern Daylight Standard Savings Time,
perfect.
Your program's on my radio. So,
well, I'm happy to hear that, Christopher. Thank you. And we're near neighbors if you live in New Albany. Thank you. Drive safe and stay safe. I appreciate it. We'll take a break, and then we have plenty more phone calls straight ahead after this. We'll move through as many as possible, as quickly as possible. The number to dial, 888-914-9149. I'll be right back. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
All right. Man, I can't believe how fast the 3 hours goes by every day. But here we are. We're almost halfway to the end of the last hour. There's still time for you to call, though. 888-914-9149. Let's start off with Claire in Traverse City, Michigan. Hi, Claire.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a little comment regarding Archbishop Cordellone. I'm not sure how it's pronounced, but mm-hmm. I think he's fantastic. I get his newsletters, but I was just wondering about, you know, I'm so thankful the Pope is calling for unity, but I just think about, like, okay, China, the German bishops, and President Biden, and mm-hmm. there doesn't seem to be a lot of unity there, so I just wondered, you know, what your thoughts were regarding that.
Well, in a way of answering it would be to point out that the bishops of the United States have corporately been working on a document on what they call Eucharistic coherence. And
yes,
that touches on the question of unity. In other words,
yes.
If we're going to be coherent in our doctrine of the real presence of Christ in the Eucharist and what's necessary to receive our Lord in Holy Communion, then it's founded on the question of unity. You know, if there is a divergence, even on something like that, where some people say, well, it doesn't matter if you're in the state of mortal sin or not, it doesn't matter if you are publicly scandalizing people or not, you can still go to communion. That's clearly a deep division that strikes at the heart of unity, as Pope Francis talks about. So, I mean, these are things that I don't think that a pope or a bishop can just decree, let there be unity, and then there will be unity. But, you know, we still have to teach and exhort and admonish on this basis, knowing that some people, for their own reasons, will refuse to be unified with the church on these issues. Politicians, errant bishops, for example, and others. So, you know, I see this as a struggle that is ongoing, and it's not something that we will ever perfectly achieve in this life.
Yes. Would it be possible for me to make one more comment real quick?
Sure. Anything for you, Claire.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, I had called, I don't know, maybe a month ago, and then my call got dropped, but it was regarding a mother calling in concerning her daughter's involvement with the occult and things along those lines. And I just wanted to share that I am a therapist, and I have been shocked by the number of people who now identify as Wiccan. And I think that we need to be very careful regarding this and pay attention and help our kids understand that it may start off sort of innocently, kind of worshiping nature or something like that, or honoring nature. But it can be a real slippery slope. It can go into the crystals and, you know, all the other stuff. But ultimately, it can get into some very dark stuff.
I can imagine you've seen some things and heard some stories, haven't you?
Oh, yes. Heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the old saying is true when it comes to the evil one. Give him an inch and he'll take a mile. And then some.
Yes.
So the best thing to do is just be very strict with yourself and avoid those things, because, you know, the slippery slope, it's easy to slide. And he makes it that way. So I'm reminded, Claire, first of all, thank you for your call. I'm reminded of that vision, that dream that St. John Bosco had, that I shared on the air a couple of weeks ago, in which he was describing the descent to hell on this, at first, very beautiful, broad boulevard that had beautiful flowers and trees, and it was easy to walk on and very pleasant. And this, of course, is a reference to what Jesus talks about in the Bible, where he says that the road is wide and well-traveled that leads to perdition or to hell. And so in his dream, St. John Bosco relates how, at first, this is a very pleasant boulevard and lots of nice things to look at, and it's easy to walk. And little by little, imperceptibly, it's sloping further downward, and the further down you go, the faster you're going, and you can't really stop yourself because so much momentum is being built up. And he talks about how once you get in that direction, the scenery is no longer beautiful anymore. It becomes wretched the further down you go, but you can't stop because you've been going and going faster and faster and faster. Then eventually those who go all the way down, they precipitate themselves directly into hell. So I've always found that vision/dream to be very edifying for me and a great reminder of how easy it is to just slip little by little into these things without even realizing it at first, because it seems so comfortable at first. Thank you, Claire. Let's go to Patricia now in Connecticut. Hi, Patricia.
Hi, Patrick. Good morning. Can you hear me?
I can, yes. Good morning.
Thank you. First of all, I want to say thank you for your ministry. As the gentleman said a few minutes ago, you're a blessing for the church, and
thank
I enjoy
you.
Your program every single day. So thank you for everything you do.
Thank you.
My question is, I had my nephew a couple of days ago in my car. We were driving back home, and he heard you saying the word stupid, right? And we are coming, well, we come from a Hispanic family. And the word in Spanish sounds even stronger, I will say.
Estúpido?
So we, estúpido,
tonto.
Yeah. So,
okay.
No, estúpido. Estúpido. Okay. Because we say the word tonto, which is not like in that level to me, at least.
That's kind of like dummy.
And,
but, hey, dummy.
Yeah, correct, correct. So the word estúpido is completely, you know, is not in our vocabulary, in neither of the words that are.
You faded out there, Patricia. We lost her signal. How about this? Jim, would you jump on the line with Patricia, see if we can figure out what's going on with her phone, and we'll get her back on the air. So, Patricia, stand by. We're going to see what's going on with your audio. Let's go, in the meantime, to Long Beach and talk to Norbert. Hi, Norbert. Welcome.
Hi. Good morning, Patrick. I have a question about the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 10, verse 34 to 36.
All righty.
Yes. Hello? Can you hear me?
You're on the air.
Okay. All right. Did Jesus, I have a question about the Gospel of Matthew, chapter 10, verse 34 to 36.
Right.
Did Jesus literally mean to some kind of division within the family or in politics? Because I, in this passage, because he says to bring the sword, so I don't know what he means by that, but he says to bring some kind of...
why don't I read it so that everybody will know what you're referring to?
Okay, yeah.
Okay, so Matthew 10, beginning in verse 34, says, "Do not suppose that I have come to bring peace to the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I have come to turn a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. A man's enemies will be members of his own household. Anyone who loves their father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Anyone who loves their son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me." Okay, so in context, what he's referring to here is that he's identifying what will happen in a family and other circumstances as well, but here in a family. What will happen if you place your relationship with your mom or your dad or your brother or sister, your daughter, your son-in-law, whoever, if you place the value on that relationship higher than the value that you place on the truth and doing the truth, in other words, being a follower of Jesus come what may, then division will naturally follow. And the same is true in reverse. If you place the value that you have on Jesus and his teachings and the truth, if you value that and are more committed to that than you are even to these relationships you have with your loved ones, division will follow. Because it was we hardly have a show that goes by in which somebody doesn't call and ask, "My sister left the Catholic Church. She's going to get married at the beach. Can I go to the wedding?" And the stock answer is, "Well, no, you shouldn't go to the wedding because she's a Catholic and this will be an invalid marriage." And you can see the pain and often the tearing apart of family relationships over something like that, where the mother or the father or whoever says, "I can't go to this because I have to obey Jesus before I follow the dictates of my personal relationships." And that causes pain. It causes division. We see it all the time. So that would be, I think, a common example of what Jesus is referring to here. He's not saying, "Hey, I want you all to be divided. I want you all to be at each other's throats." That's not what he means by this. So he's not prescribing this, he's describing this. He's saying this is what will happen, even in families, when you place the truth above lesser things. And so don't be surprised when this happens. Does that make sense, Norbert?
Right, yeah. So from my understanding, like attachment, some kind of a spiritual attachment.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't even have to be spiritual. I mean, it can be familial. It can be just,
yeah, familiar.
"Well, I don't want to offend my brother because, you know, he's going to get married to another man. And, you know, I don't want to ruffle any feathers. And I like him. I love him. He's my brother. So I'm going to go to the wedding and be his best man and pretend that everything's great." That's the kind of thing that Jesus is talking about, where you compromise what you know to be true because you're choosing your family relationship, as important as that is. And let's face it, these are very important relationships. They should be preserved and cherished and protected. But sometimes you can't. And so Jesus is saying, eventually, you're going to have to make a decision for or against the truth. You're either going to follow Jesus or you're going to follow some lesser good, in which case that becomes even a false god. It's a form of idolatry to choose to follow something that is lesser than God himself when push comes to shove.
Right. All right. All right. I understand where you're going.
Okay. Well, that's good. I'm glad that we, you know, these are important passages to consider, so I'm glad you brought it up. Thank you. Let's go back to Patricia. Okay, so Patricia in Connecticut, we somehow lost your signal, but it looks like you're back. Welcome.
Yes, thank you, Patrick, for patience.
Sure. No problem.
So I don't know if you were able to hear all my comments on the word, you know, stupid. And, well, my nephew's 12 years old, and we have taught him to do not, to try to avoid those words. And if he wants to express something like that to someone, he can use something that's like, you know, he doesn't know well, or he's not well informed, you know, those kind of words. So try to avoid those things. So a couple of days ago, he was in my car and we were listening to your show, and he heard you saying the word. So he turned to me saying, like, well, why does Patrick say the word? That's not good. So I tried to explain him, you know, that sometimes you use them for, you know, to explain something or to say, you know, I really, truly didn't have words to explain completely. So once he has heard from us all the time that those
words Patrick Madrid said it. So how, yeah, I understand what you're saying. And I'm sorry that that caused you a moment of heartburn. So let me try to explain it. First thing I will say is I really do admire you and anyone who has a sensitivity to vulgar speech. Now, I don't regard stupid as vulgar, so we'll come back to that word stupid in a minute. But I admire you for having a sensitivity to that, because the more pure of speech someone is, I think the more you see the condition of their soul. And quite frankly, you know, people who use four-letter words indiscriminately, people who are, they swear at the drop of a hat, you know, the F-bombs and all that kind of stuff. I think it's an indicator of what's going on inside. So it may not be the exact truth in any given case, but I think generally you can tell a lot about a person if he's vulgar and crude and profane, etc. So that's my first point. I admire you for being sensitive about this. I have noticed that it's possible to be overly sensitive about certain words that are in themselves not objectionable. And I would say stupid is in that category. Now, I mean, I speak Spanish too. And, you know, to use the word estúpido, I can see what you mean. If you say that to a person or about a person, that's pretty hard-edged, instead of say tonto or something like that. But in English, maybe that's just a function of the way in which the word comes across in the English language as less harsh, perhaps. So when I say that's a stupid idea, or this is stupid, or, you know, how stupid of him to do that, I think that's entirely reasonable and at times appropriate to say that about something, because it is stupid in some cases. It's stupid to say a lot of things that are being said nowadays, and to call it that is sometimes necessary. So I take that approach to that particular word, and that was why your son heard me say the term stupid, because from time to time I do use it. Now, I wouldn't say, I mean, there are a lot of things that I would never say, because it would be too vulgar, too harsh, too crude, or things. And I don't say those even in my private life when I'm not on the radio. One of the things that I learned from my father, and this gets to the point of how you're raising your son, Patricia, is my father especially, and this is also true of my mother, so I don't mean to exclude her because she was the same way. But as I look back on it when I got older, I realized that I had never heard my father curse. I never heard him say a swear word. I never heard him even say damn. Not that I encourage it, but I never heard him say it. So if he got cut off in traffic, or if he hit his thumb with a hammer when he was working on something in the garage, he, you know, He might yell, but he never said a bad word like that. Now, I realized later that although he never sat me down and gave me a lecture about don't use bad words or anything, it was how he acted and how he lived his life. He was pure of speech, always pure of speech. And it made a great impression upon me. And I didn't realize it at the time. And when I got older, I realized what a gift he had given me. So, you know, I think about that and I relate it to what you're saying. You're trying to teach your children the same type of decorum and politeness in how they talk. And I think that's a good thing. So I hope that my use of the word stupid didn't unnecessarily complicate things for you.
Thank you. He actually was going to call you. He's like, I got to call Patrick and ask him for an explanation, you know, because this is not right. He's in the radio and many children are listening to him. So he should not say that. So, and I was like, okay, you call Patrick later then.
But so in my defense, I'll leave it at this.
Not my son, but he's my nephew.
Fair enough. And in my defense, I'll just say this. I personally believe that there's nothing wrong with saying stupid. So I may be sensitive to other things, but I don't think that word, I think maybe, if I could put it this way, Patricia, just between you and me, I think maybe given the distinction or the connotations between Spanish and English, that if you say it in English, you don't really have to be worried about it being bad. I don't think it rises to that level at all. I think it's entirely a safe word to use when it's used properly. I want to share one more detail with you, Patricia, because you speak Spanish. You know the word cochinada, right?
Oh, yeah.
My dad used that word all the time. You know that cochinada, because my dad grew up speaking Spanish.
That's not bad.
No, it's not bad. It's not. So he would use that word when he might have been thinking of a different word. So he would say cochinada.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. I think that is the language that is. It's a little different because, as you said, you know, in Spanish, the word estúpido is really a tough word, you know.
Yeah.
So, and probably in English, it doesn't have that effect. So,
I think that's the best way to put it. It doesn't have the same impact or edge the way it would in Spanish. So, hey, I've got to run, Patricia, but thank you very much and very nice talking to you. I'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
All right, we are back. Thanks for listening. 888-914-9149. We'll go first to Susan in California. Hello, Susan.
Hi. I have a quick question. I have a question that when somebody reaches, you know, old age and they've never been baptized and in their lucid days, you know, before they were exposed to God and they were talked about the importance of knowing God, but they kind of rejected it. Mm-hmm. Now that a person's reached dementia, is there any possibility that they could still be baptized?
Yes. What I think would be necessary would be if, in other words, this person, can he or she carry on a conversation? Can he or she be lucid enough if you ask the question?
Yeah. Well, yeah, he can, but he's quite confused on pretty much his life.
Susan, let me put it this way. And I'm just looking at the clock because I don't want to run out of time with you.
Yeah.
So if you, mm-hmm. if he's alert enough for you to say, you know, God loves you, right? And he may say, yes, I know that. Or do you love God? Yes, I do love God. Do you want to be happy with God in heaven? Yes, I do. I mean, simple baby questions like that are sufficient.
Okay.
And if Very he's good. Sufficiently aware to answer even simple baby questions like that, then he would be an apt candidate to be baptized. Now, if he said, no, I don't believe in God, or no, I don't want, I mean, that would be a different story, of course. But if his general orientation toward God here and now, even with his limitation, even with his lack of lucidity, if he can at least say, and there's, you know, no reason not to believe that he means it, if he can say those things, then he would be ready for baptism.
Wow. Okay, great. And I could easily baptize this person then. I mean, if I'm worried about getting a priest in here and he might reject the man.
No, I wouldn't worry about that. I would not do the baptism unless he's in danger of death. If he's, you know, okay. clearly in danger of death, then yes, you can baptize. But the church wants the baptism to be done in, you know, the proper manner. And because he's not in danger of death, it sounds like I would just work with the priest and just, you know, say, I've been talking to this man. Come meet him. Come pray with him. He says he loves God. He says he wants to be happy with God. And he's ready for baptism. So can you come baptize him? And the priest will probably do
Great.
That.
Okay. Well, perfect. That's what I wanted to know. Thank
All right.
you so much.
Thank you. You're a guardian angel to this man. I'm sure when he gets baptized and if he gets to heaven before you do, Susan, he's going to be ready to greet you when you get up there. Let's go to Pearl now in San Antonio, Texas. Hi, Pearl.
Hello, Patrick. How does the Catholic Church justify, through Catholic Charities, allowing the transport of illegal aliens coming from all over the world? We don't know what diseases they may have. A lot of them do have the coronavirus. Mm-hmm. How does the Catholic Church justify Catholic Charities transporting these people, illegal aliens, throughout our country with diseases, especially the coronavirus, and dropping them off in our airports and bus stations? And I don't understand. Number one, they're breaking immigration law. I understand they could lose their tax exemption by breaking laws, our constitutional laws. But I don't understand how the Catholic Church can justify even the people in Cuba who want to come to this country legally, who are Christians, most of them conservative, are being told now they're not welcomed here.
Mm-hmm. Well, to answer your question, Pearl, I do not know either. I don't justify that. And I'm sure that they would probably say, well, because Christ said, welcome the stranger. And he certainly did say that. And we're obliged to do so. But we have to do so in a way that's just and helps the greater good. I agree with you that it is a very strange anomaly, although it's understandable how immigrants who come from other countries and tend to, when they settle here, they tend to vote Democratic. They tend to vote for Democratic candidates. They tend to be useful tools of the Democratic Party. And as you said, those who come from Cuba tend to be conservative, and they tend to not vote for Democrats. So, I mean, I think it's transparently obvious why these very same people in Congress and elsewhere are adamant that we should let people come in an unrestricted fashion from these other countries where they're more likely to be Democratic voters, and they don't want the Cubans to come in. I think it's obvious why that's going on. But you'd have to ask them, because they're the ones who are doing this, or at least supporting this, and I don't agree with them. So I guess in a way you're kind of asking the wrong person. I don't know what to tell you.
Okay. Do I address the Catholic bishops, Patrick? Would that question be addressed
if you wanted
to the bishops?
To. Sure. Now, the bishops have statements. I mean, Archbishop Gomez of Los Angeles, I mean, he's at sort of the forefront of the immigration discussion among the bishops, and there are others in Texas and elsewhere. So I know that their desire to serve these poor people and help them is genuine. I have no objection to that at all. But as Archbishop Gomez himself has said, the immigration system and our immigration policies and procedures are broken, and they're not equitable. They're not, in many respects, they're not just, including in many ways, they're not just to American citizens. And And so these are all problems that I don't have the ability to resolve. The bishops have a leadership role in this area. So, yes, if you wanted to approach them or write them a letter. But I would begin by reading what they have to say on the issue. But in terms of the indiscriminate moving, shipping illegal immigrants from other countries, just you know, dumping them in cities and towns all around the country and not providing the means necessary to be integrated into this country, including legally speaking, that's a really serious problem. And I don't like what's being done, and I don't justify it. So you'd have to ask them, Pearl. Thank you. Let's go now to David, who's listening in Prairie Grove, Arkansas. Hi, David.
Hey, Patrick. Thank you for taking my call. Real quickly here, the salutation to the Blessed Virgin from the angel Gabriel, in Greek, it says Ketchar Tomini. I'm sorry for the pronunciation of that.
Ketchar Tomini. Yes.
Right. It's I understand it to be a novel word used only once in the Bible and probably only once in any Greek literature. And I was just wondering what you, I understand the translation is to be full of grace. But I was wondering, you know, that's there's also twice in the Bible where full of grace is used, but it's not used as ketchotomini. It's another a Greek phrase. I'm sorry I had it here written down, but
I have it right in front of me. It's kikaritomene. So it is a Greek participle. It is a hapax legomenon in terms of that exact word, but there are participial forms of other words, including referring to grace, that do appear elsewhere. Are you asking me why do we translate it in English as full of grace, or what's the question?
Right. Why do we translate it as full of grace? And also, in my New American Bible, it's translated as favored one.
Right. Okay. Well, favored one is not the literal meaning of that phrase in the Greek, and it's also not the literal meaning of what Jerome. Translated into Latin as. So in the Latin Vulgate, this is Luke 1:28, et ingressus angelus ad eam dixit, have gratia plena, Dominus tecum, benedicta tu in mulieribus. And that phrase, gratia plena, it literally means full of grace. So I would advert to St. Jerome's example here and say that he was a master, not only of the Latin language, but he was a master of Koine Greek and a master of Hebrew, for that matter. And so he understood the implications of this greeting in the Greek, and he translated it in the Latin as full of grace. So I think that's a safe course of action to look to him as a guide for how we should be translating this into English. Now, keep in mind that some biblical translations are not intended to be slavishly literal. Some are intended to be more paraphrastic. They want to capture, maybe in a colloquial way, what is being said without slavishly, literally translating it. And so this is why you see some less literal ways of saying it, like a highly favored one. That's not the literal translation, but it was their attempt to try to capture the meaning of it. But my objection to that would be, and of course I wasn't consulted, but my objection to that would be, the meaning of this passage is so important, especially given the Church's Marian doctrines, that I don't think it serves anyone to have a paraphrastic translation. I think we should stick as close to the literal meaning as possible to clear up any confusion about what was being said. But again, I wasn't consulted, so I had no say in the matter.
Okay. And also, do you think that that's the Virgin Mary's heavenly name?
No, I mean, it's a title, so the angel Gabriel addressed her with what became a title there. Later in that same passage, Our Lady, when she visits St. Elizabeth, she says, all generations will call me blessed. That, too, is a title. We call her the Blessed Virgin Mary. But her name as Mary, that's her name, and I guess we'll find out in heaven if there's more to it. Maybe there's some name that God will give you that is beyond anything you have right now. We'll find out. I've got to press on, though. Thank you, David. Let's go to Stella now in Los Angeles. Hi, Stella.
Hi, Patrick. Quick question about keeping the Sabbath holy and working sure. on Sundays. Are we allowed to work? Should we not work? How strict is it?
Well, the spirit in the letter of the law holds that you should do no servile work, and that's translated typically as unnecessary work. So if your job requires you to be working on a Sunday because you're a physician or you're a police officer mm-hmm. or, you know, you have some other duty okay. that it's mm-hmm. not, you know, like you can't necessarily take weekends off, you're not committing any sin because you have to work. You know, if you are trying to feed your family and the only job you can get requires you to work on Sunday, well, you're not offending because you have to work. But if on a Sunday you start doing all that work that you could have done on Saturday or the rest of the week, you just put it off until Sunday, that would be an infringement upon the commandment to keep holy the Lord's Day.
Okay.
Unnecessary work, in other words.
I guess I'm mostly asking because I'm thinking of picking up a part-time job on Sunday, but don't know if I should or not. But
yeah, I hear you. If I were you, I mean, if it were me, I would try to avoid it. And I've told all my kids that when they were getting their jobs, you know, see if you can get a job that doesn't require you to work on Sunday. If it's absolutely necessary and you really need that job, that's a different story. But I wish you well, Stella. Thank you. I'll pray for you. Please pray for me. God bless you.